Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, and we're going to have a show, a deep show, with a deep guy. Our guest is an amazing human being in the world, a very being. And I just finished his book called The Art of Healing, and I love it. I'm going to be recommending it, of course, to everybody. It's an amazing journey into what it takes to be good at what you do, because you got to be good. You got to be the person. And this man knows how to be. And I'm so impressed with him. I learned so much in his book, and I'm really excited to speak with Bernie Siegel. Bernie, welcome.
Well, thank you.
Yes.
You know, let me say that it's hard to get men to participate in all the things that I do in terms of drawings, emotions, feelings, group meetings. And you sound like a top quality guy to be able to share what you just did.
Well, I always say I'm not a joiner. But then again, I'm a processor, and I love to speak and teach and express and share and come from a place of authenticity, the best that I know how. And that's what I love about what you've practiced in your life, and in a position where you didn't have to, because you had it made. You were a doctor, and you were out there. You could have been just like anybody else, and you chose to be unique.
Well, I'll say that what made it happen, yes, I had to make a choice, but I always say I became a doctor for healthy reasons. then it became a painful occupation, meaning that I wanted to help people and care for people, and all the things you can't fix and cure, and just all the disasters you watch, and you really begin to wonder, you know, what is life about? What's it like? And why didn't they tell me this in medical school so I can handle this?
It's
and
painful.
The deans of the medical schools, when I wrote to them, never wrote back to me.
Yeah.
You know, to tell them that I became a wonderful technician, but I don't know how to take care of people. And what altered my life, in a sense, was one of my patients. At a meeting I went to thinking it was for doctors to help cancer patients, because it was run by a physician. I was the only doctor in the audience. And almost everyone there was a cancer patient. And she said, the end of her statement was, I need to know how to live between office visits. And that's when I started learning about my patients and their will to live. And, you know, when they didn't die when they were supposed to, that they were teaching me things about how they changed their life.
Yeah, you made your office visits even more important.
Yeah, right. As men, just a couple of anecdotes that we became human doings, not human beings, because I've had men in the office, literally, with their wife and children sitting next to them, say, I can't work. What's the point of living? It just would blow my mind. I would point out, well, how about these three reasons to your left? You know, and one woman, the wife called me because I've been working with the husband. He was improving, and then suddenly she calls me and says, today we saw the oncologist. He said to my husband, you can't work, sail your boat, or play tennis anymore. And my husband went home and committed suicide. Now, you know, to me, that's not a reason to commit suicide. But, and the other, one last anecdote, in our support group, which we've been running for decades, when husbands show up with the wife who is sick, which is rare, okay, it's a minority of the guys who come at all, but I say, hey, let's introduce ourselves. I'm her chauffeur. And the room bursts out laughing. And the husband always says, what's funny? I said, we've been hearing that answer for the last 30 years. You know, it has nothing to do with feelings. It's, I'm her chauffeur. And literally, in all those years, only about six guys have said, well, I'm here because I love her. You know, then the room is in awe. But, you know, the guys have to get over just doing things and begin to create relationships, which is also what keeps women alive and living longer than men, and married men longer than single men, because, again, the relationships change our chemistry and help keep us healthy for a longer period of time.
You know, I counsel single women often, and I always feel bad because I always say to them, you know, good men are hard to find.
That's right.
So
yeah, I use, as you know from the book, drawings, and I will say to them, you know, draw the men in your life. You know, if they're trying to decide who to marry, what to do. And you can see where the relationship is a healthy one and where it isn't an appropriate one. So it helps them know their inner wisdom and their intuitive, you know, sense of a resource rather than just living in their head and thinking all the time.
I do want to get into the drawing work that you do, but first I just want to come back to my impression of what it takes to be true to oneself. And that's how you heal people, actually, not only being
Absolutely.
True to yourself, but helping them to become true to themselves.
Yeah, I think that I didn't understand the problem that the world had because I was loved by my parents and grandparents. So I didn't stop and think, you know, what do other people think of me? Is this the right thing to do? Because, again, my mother's, what I call mottos to live by now were, do what makes you happy, and difficulties are God redirecting you. So, I mean, she drove me crazy as a kid with those answers. But I learned that, you know, keep your mind open. You don't know the future. And my father's father died when he was 12 of tuberculosis. Family of six kids with no money, a disaster. And he said it was one of the best things that happened to him. And I said, what are you talking about? He said, it taught me what was important about life. So he also was my teacher.
That's very sad. Yeah, that's right. I lost my father when I was young. And that's why I do what I do today.
Right.
Is help people and seek deeper answers and help people treasure life more. And
when they find what I call their authentic life, and many of them, because of a disaster, you know, they learn, oh, I could die. That's right. Then let me start looking at my life. See, that was the thing that became fascinating to me, that when people realize, well, it's easier to quote a letter. The doctor told me I had 2 months to live. This time I felt so sick, I agree with the doctor. So I went home, and I bought a dog, and I put in a wildlife backyard habitat, and I laughed more, and I took some vitamins, and the letter ends with, and I didn't die. Now I'm so busy, I'm killing myself. Help, where do I go from here? And
That's
I
good.
Told her to take a nap. But, I mean, those are the things I began to see happening, you know, that when people quit a law office, picked up a violin, because literally this fella gave up his life to make his parents happy. You know, we could be proud of a lawyer, but playing a violin. And he got a job in an orchestra, and instead of being dead, he's having a wonderful time playing the violin in an orchestra. Or another fellow said, I want to go to Colorado and die in the mountains. It's beautiful there. I told the family to call me for the funeral. A year later, I had not had a phone call, so I was really angry at the family for ignoring my feelings. And I called up, and the man answered the phone. He said, it was so beautiful here, I forgot to die. I mean, so I could tell these stories forever, but and I can't guarantee anything to anyone. You know, I can't say that just because you do these things, your disease is going to disappear. But I can tell you that it will give you a life you can love and give you a body that you can love.
Early in your book, you say that you're interested in helping people learn how to live or
right.
die in harmony, wholeness, and peace.
Yeah.
So we can't hold on to everything.
No. But, yeah, that's the other thing I saw, that when people got tired of their body, well, quote my father, he said to my mother, I need to get out of here. My mother said, oh, he wants to get out of bed. I said, Mom, he's talking about his body. So she gave him permission. And he didn't have trouble dying with everybody in the family who could get there, you know, around his bed. And I may add, he died laughing because my mother was telling stories about their early dates and meetings and all the crazy things that happened. And I've seen that in my parents and my in-laws. Because my father-in-law, he had injured his spinal cord, was basically quadriplegic from a fall off his back porch. And one night at 97, he was an incredible guy living all those years. He said to us, "I don't want my vitamins and I don't want my dinner." And we knew he was telling us, "I'm done." And he died quietly that night. And my description of his death was he just fell up, because that was a term he used to tell seniors how to avoid a problem. He said, "Tell them to just fall up."
I love that.
Yeah. And so I put that on his headstone, which confuses some people. But it was just such a classic example of him living that message, you know. I'm ready to go. And he left. Because, again, the family wasn't arguing. "No, you can't. No, you know, you don't eat your dinner." There was one doctor who called me. She said her mother had been brain dead for 2 years, was being tube-fed. And the family wanted to let her go. But the lawyer said, "If you pull the tube out, you're murdering her." So they would not accept her at hospice. I told the family, "Come on, we'll meet. We'll stand around your mother's bed." And I said, "Tell her that it's okay for her to go. Her love will stay with you." And they all started crying. I said, "All right, I'll speak for you." And people hear you under anesthesia, in coma,
yes,
sleeping, etc.
Yes.
So I said to her, "Your family's standing around the bed. They all love you. Your love will stay with them. If you need to go, it's okay." 15 minutes later, she died.
All right, good.
And I have to add, so people are not afraid to say this, because one family wrote me and said, "We drove for 2 hours to our mother-in-law, and we told her it's okay to go because we were feeling guilty about all she was going through. And after we said, 'Mom, it's okay to go,' she said, 'I'm not going anywhere.'" You know, but they came home free of guilt with a smile, knowing the woman was alive, still
yeah,
appreciating life.
And they,
you know,
did their best.
Yeah, they weren't doing anything wrong.
When my mother was in a coma in her last few days, she was unresponsive to anything but the statement, when we would say, "I love you," she'd grunt.
Mm.
But anything else we would say, there was no response to. So I agree that people in comas are aware. There's just only so much that they can do about it.
Right. Well, you know, the name of your show, The Energy Stew, I like that.
Thank you.
Because my definition of God is intelligent, loving, conscious energy. And, you know, if you mix all those things together, it's like the stew. But it's what creation is about, you know, and that is available to all of us to help us to heal and survive and, you know, be in touch with.
Yes, and you are a role model, and that's what reading your book is so important, I think, for people to learn how to be through your example. And it goes on. There's so many parts of the book I really love. I do want to talk about art, because it really was helpful for me to see how important it is. I was an art history major in college.
Mm.
So I come from an artist family. So I really do believe in how important art is. And you really describe, you have so many examples of art that are illustrated in your book, and then you examine them.
Yeah, 70 drawings. So.
Yeah. And you examine them and show how they work or not. I recommend to people, though, before they read that, that they follow some instructions about sitting down with a paper and a full set of crayons and have some idea of what kind of picture they need to draw of people or places or events, and draw them first before they read your book, because I'm too conscious now of all the different all the things that colors mean.
Well, let
shapes.
Me say this to you. Don't worry about that. it is better to draw it without the instructions. You know, where should I live? What job should I take? Who should I marry? Whatever. But what I've learned is, you see, I know all about these drawings.
Right.
And what began to blow my mind was I would draw a picture, you see, when we were at a workshop, and I would want to be sure everybody knew, you know, my life is perfect, everything's wonderful. And, well, an example, you know, I draw my wife and I and our 5 kids standing together, you know, so we'll all hold hands and, you know, be close and it'll look wonderful for people. And when I held the picture up, I realized one of the boys wasn't holding hands with either of his brothers on either side. And it was like, how did that happen? But, I mean, at that time, the kid was driving us crazy, you know. And that's what impressed me. See, the unconscious blinds you.
But you weren't.
What I tell people is, draw the picture, but do not analyze it till the next day. Then you're seeing it, you know, intellectually, as if somebody else drew it. So you'll notice things that you would never have noticed if you just, you know, looked at it right away and said, all right, let me analyze this. So wait a day, let your intellect come back in. Then you look at it and you'll notice, you know, I don't have ears or I don't have hands or, you know, things of that sort. Or there's no chimney on the house, whatever it is that may mean something. And you'll be able to analyze it as if someone else drew it and learn about yourself.
And they can learn how to analyze it better reading your book because you do analyze so many drawings.
Yeah, and I mentioned other books, too, because
there's
a lot of art therapists. See, I thought I was discovering something because I drew a picture for Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. Couldn't believe how much she knew about my life from this outdoor scene I drew. And so I went back to the hospital getting my patients to draw. And then I thought, look what I'm discovering. You sent it to medical journals. They said it was interesting, but it's not appropriate. So I sent them to where it was appropriate. It came back again saying, yeah, it's appropriate, but it's not interesting. We know all this. And I thought, then why didn't somebody teach me that in medical school too? You know, and even this statement I always make, because I have never met a doctor who has ever been told this. And I read it. Nobody told it to me. Carl Jung interpreted a dream and correctly diagnosed a brain tumor. Now, I think doctors ought to be told that. So they say to patients, have you had a dream? Do you know, you know, have a sense of feeling of what this is? Because, again, I use the drawings to diagnose illnesses and disease and decide whether to operate or not. And I mean that, literally. I mean, it's not that I didn't do other things, you know, as a typical doctor would. But I use this inner wisdom from the patient to help me make decisions. You know, it impressed people ultimately in the hospital. So they even made up coloring books in the operating room to get the kids to draw, you know, pictures before and learned from them how they were going to do, what dangers the children saw. I mean, one picture I included, the child literally drew a picture of the operating room she'd never been in. You know, it's symbolic, but it's like where there were two lights, she draws two yellow, you know, areas. And all the colors and the numbers of people that are in the operating room are all in her picture. So those are the things we have to wake up to let the unconscious come forth and be a resource for us.
And it, you know, describes
thinking all the time.
Right, it can describe the future.
Yeah, absolutely. Past, present, and future.
Yes.
And numbers, that's another thing that Jung talked about. Numbers are the way we store these memories. You know, when somebody, again, that drawing by a reporter who drew one hand on a clock pointed at 12, and it changed our interview when I said to her, what happened when you were 12 years old? Oh, I don't like deadlines. I said, there's only one hand on the clock. And then come the tears and the abuse, you know, and the stories that happened at that age. And believe me, it changed the interview because she was very intellectual and thought I was a little nuts until that drawing I got her to do and discussed it with her.
I think your book, the primary audience for your book is doctors, even though everybody else needs to read it. Because
I hope that's really why I put it out there with the drawings. I hope it'll wake up the medical profession.
Well, it would be great if you can find doctors who not only want to learn this, but want to learn how to incorporate it into the profession.
Right.
Not only for themselves, but to even to help teach it in medical school.
Yeah. You see, one is like a lot of doctors would say to me, oh, I'm so busy, who has time for drawings? I said, it saves you time. Because we had a family, the child had cancer. She had three siblings, parents, you know, there's six people. And the child said, I don't get enough time for my family. I said, are you going to sit there talking to six people, trying to find out what they do all day? I said to her, honey, draw me a picture of the family. And she's sitting on a chair all by herself, The family's on a sofa with an empty seat on the sofa, but she's not with them. And, you know, their arms are around each other, not available to her. That impacted the parents, you see. In a couple of minutes, look what your daughter is saying. They went home and made a big change because this is a child with cancer and, you know, she had needs because of the disease. And they responded and they thanked me many times over the next few years for that moment with that drawing, because it changed how they related right. to their daughter.
I had a client come to see me. I'm an intuitive, and she came to see me because her four-year-old daughter wasn't producing red blood cells, and they can only. She had been to the hospital, and you know, I guess there's only so much they can do. They couldn't get them started again, so she was. They were really worried about her life. And the mother came to me and said, what are we going to do? I said, well, intuitively, let me give you the answer. You go home, and your husband holds her in his arms for 3 hours while she watches you do chores around the house. And she said, that's it? And I said, yeah, that's what she needs. And they did that, and her red blood cells kicked back in again right after that.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I keep saying is the biggest public health issue on the planet is parenting. That if the children grow up feeling loved, they live longer, healthier lives. And it's because they have self-worth, self-esteem, so they care for and about themselves.
Right. It gives
and
them permission.
They don't grow up with love. Yeah, it's self-destructive. And I can right. cite lots of statistics, but it's absolutely true. Mm-hmm. You know, you go into, I always say, assisted living, you know, 80, 90, 100-year-olds, and say, your parents love you. And almost every hand in the room goes up. And I always say, that's why you're all alive. High school students, 70% in one study said they contemplated suicide. So, you know, that's the sad part. And we need to bring the kids up with love. And it does bring back their life. I mean, I could tell you more stories of kids who, one newborn, premature, was given to the mother saying, it's dying, you can hold it now. You know, because the kid was in isolation, and the mother took the dying baby, put it against her bare breast, and the baby started sucking milk and came back to life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, shocked yeah. the hospital, but maybe they learned something, too.
Something big.
You know, like the father holding the child. Yeah, that right. a massage changes you also. Babies that are massaged gain weight, and their brain develops faster than infants fed the same amount, but not touched. And in the orphanages way back in the 1800s, all the kids died of infections because nobody was touching them, thinking, we're spreading infections, don't touch them.
And there's that
but
story of...
They were killing them.
There's a story of orphanages in Romania where the women were never... For some reason, there were rules. They couldn't touch the children. They
yeah.
couldn't caress them. And most of those children grew into criminals.
Mm-hmm.
They had no empathy, no yeah. understanding of love.
Yeah, all that. I mean, people have to understand that I call it survivor behavior. You know, that doctors need to teach people what qualities will help them to survive. Well, what summed it up, Solzhenitsyn in his book Cancer Ward talks about self-induced healing as a rainbow-colored butterfly fluttering out of the book. When I read that, yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. what he's talking about, first of all, self-induced, see, not a spontaneous remission or a miracle that you don't learn from, but self-induced. And it was a rainbow-colored butterfly, the rainbow being your life in order, the butterfly your symbol of transformation. So you transform your life, create order and harmony, and a byproduct is the self-induced healing.
And there's a beautiful story. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, no, Mother Teresa summarized it in another way. She said, I won't attend an anti-war rally, but if you ever have a peace rally, call me. So if people heal their lives, find peace, you know, rather than empowering the enemy and killing the disease, fighting for your life, no, heal your life.
And you
love your life.
And you teach that about drawing, too, that you don't draw yeah. wartime. You draw
right.
something peaceful.
Yeah.
And that reveals
yeah.
enough.
Well, my Quaker friend, who was a conscientious objector, developed cancer, went to an oncologist who, thinking he was saying something good to him, said, "Dave, I'm going to kill your cancer." And Dave said, "I don't kill anything. I'm a conscientious objector." And he walked out of the office. Uh-huh. I mean, he lived for over 12 years doing, you know, his alternative thing. But you see, again, if the doctor knew his patient and said, "Dave, I'm going to make you well," Dave wouldn't have had any trouble. Because even in his drawings, he carries his cancer cells away. He doesn't hurt anything.
And in the book, and you talk about how doctors talk to people and how they shouldn't be talking to people. And there's so much. I hear it all the time from my clients who come in and say, "Oh, my doctor just told me I'm dying. I only have a few months to live." Mm. And how does a doctor know?
But they, right. I always offer them $10,000 to bet the doctor they live for six more months beyond the doctor. Right. And I said, because the doctor won't bet. He'll say, "Well, you could. I'm not going to risk $10,000.
But the doctor's glad that he told this person, gave this person the death sentence.
Well, yeah, it keeps the doctor empowered in an unhealthy way.
Right.
You know? One of our kids taught me this because he wrote the word "words" on a canvas in an art class. Words, 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 words. I always say to people, write it down. No space between the words. And you notice it becomes sword, 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 sword.
Right.
So you can kill a cure with words. You can kill a cure with a sword, you know, a scalpel. And people have to understand that. And doctors, I call it deceiving people into health, because doing a lot of children's surgery, the kids, you know, saw me as an authority. So what I said to them happened. And therefore, I always, in a sense, hypnotize them in a positive way. You know, I'm telling them a lie, but they believe me. You know, if I rub their arm with an alcohol sponge and say, "Now your skin is numb, you won't feel the needle. There's a new kind of sponge." A third of the kids would say, "That's wonderful. Why don't the other doctors do that?" And the other kids would say, "You know, I still felt it." I said, "Oh, it must have been a bad sponge." But, you know, there was none of the emotional, "Oh, a needle, oh, you know." Mm-hmm. You know, kind of thing. And or even the anesthesiologist would often say, "This will be like a bee sting." I said, "How about a mosquito bite?" You know, I mean, why scare the person? Just make, you know, use words that will help them and induce healing and comfort. Right. Because kids fell asleep going into the operating room, I mean, literally on the stretcher, because I had said in the emergency room, "You'll go to sleep when you go in the operating room." And I didn't realize how they interpreted it. They interpreted it not as anesthesia, but as sleep. And they fell asleep going into the room.
Amazing.
And then they get mad at me for waking them up.
Well,
we're
running out of time, and I'm so glad to speak with you. Hopefully we can do it again, because your wisdom is really healing for everybody. And this book is such a healing book, The Art of Healing.
Thank you.
Bernie Siegel.
I always say we're all going to run out of time, so enjoy your lifetime.
Right. Thanks so much, Bernie Siegel, for being a guest on Energy Stew. And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I can be reached at peter@heartriver, heartriver.org, or 212-222-7748. And thank you so much for listening.